Robert Plant is in the mood. Hope you are as well. Buckle up, pilgrims, because father and son paranormal investigators Paul Eno and Ben Eno, with a combined 55 years of experience as paranormal researchers, say everything you know is wrong. Are they correct? You know, in this program, I often brought up this phrase about the unified theory of weirdness, the idea that somehow the topics that we discuss on this program are interconnected. And that's exactly where this new book, Behind the Paranormal, by Paul and Ben starts. It's sort of a description of what you might call the paranormal multiverse, a schematic, a matrix, almost a blueprint of how all this weird stuff fits together, a model for reality that makes sense for those of us who explore these topics. Paul Eno and Ben Eno are my guests in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Paul Eno has been studying the paranormal, investigating the paranormal since the early 70s. He started at a time when he was studying for the priesthood, which means he's coming at this from an angle that we don't often see in the field. He graduated from two seminaries, but was expelled from a third because he was interested in what we would call paranormal. More on that definition in a moment. He ended up becoming a journalist, wrote five books on the paranormal, two books on history, and his investigations taught him early on that it appeared to be connections, that if you looked at a ghost case, there might be, if you researched it enough, it turned into a UFO case and other never-before-suspected connections between ghosts and cryptids and UFOs. His son, Ben Eno, joined his father's adventures in 2005 when he was just 13 years old, but he demonstrated unique insights of his own, and at 16, he became the youngest syndicated broadcaster in America. The two men, father and son, have a radio show called Behind the Paranormal that airs in Boston and Providence and New England area, northeastern area, I should say. Their new book takes its title from their radio show. It, too, is called Behind the Paranormal, Everything You Know Is Wrong. Welcome back to the program, Paul and Ben Eno. Guys, good to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, George.
Yes, thank you.
I really, really like how you start this book with sort of a, as I've mentioned a couple of times, you know, that the approach of whether or not these are all connected is something near and dear to my heart and something I've explored as well, and one that we talk about on this program a lot. But you set it up so well in the introduction, first with a sort of a definition of paranormal that really sets a tone for the book. Paul, why don't you start with that?
Well, sure, George. The paranormal, in our opinion, has very little to do, or if anything, with spirits of the dead and all this business. Maybe not even so much with people from other planets, but pretty much it is, in our view, and it took a long time to come to this view, the rather elegant and free interaction between parallel worlds where all possibilities exist in concrete reality. And the reason... this came from the experience of going into, say, a house that was supposed to be haunted, and you would encounter what seemed to be entities there, but very often they'd be afraid of us, or me in early days, thinking I was a ghost haunting them. You know, what is this about? Why would we see them wearing clothes or driving cars or things of this kind? And I began to realize that the old 19th century definitions that everybody just assumes are true are not good enough. And so I think we're dealing with multiple parallel worlds rather than with some material world versus a spirit world.
And Ben, you guys also make the point early in the book about how, you know, we tend to see these paranormal events as the unusual, episodic kind of a thing. It's a little hiccup. It's a pimple on the asphalt, so to speak. Whereas your model for this thing suggests that it actually is the bigger picture.
Well, I mean, as we like to say, the paranormal is normal. It's going on all the time. The whole world is haunted everywhere, everyone, and at all times. I think it's more how we perceive things. I always like to say that the way we think is like the framework of a house. Everyone has their own different kind of house and their own different kind of framework and how they view things. But really, in the end, we have to look outside the framework that we all have to see what's really, truly going on.
I would also ask you, Ben, to talk about ghost hunters, because you make an allusion to it early on in the book, and I think I can sense you tiptoeing around it, that you want to be careful you don't insult these folks you see at the ghost hunter TV shows on television that are sometimes just preposterous. that give the whole endeavor a bad name, because you know the techniques that are used and the results that never seem to materialize. And I know you don't want to get on the bad side of those folks. They might be your guests on your radio show. They are very often pursuing this for honest reasons, a sense of inquiry and inquisitiveness. But you do see problems in some of the approaches of these guys.
Well, yeah, there have been a few times where my dad and I have spoken at conferences, and I've had people come up to me and they're like, oh, well, we're going to prove this, 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 and this. And I'm just like, well, who are you trying to prove this to? And they stop and they think, and they're just like, oh, I never really thought of that before. It's like, well, think of it like this. We have a materialistic science paradigm that we're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. Like, you can't take all of the paranormal phenomena that my father and I have seen and everyone else has seen and experienced and try to fit that into, well, you know, it's all matter and energy. It's hard to fit something that's indescribable into something that is describable. So I get frustrated, I'm assuming you do as well, George, that we're trying to describe something, whereas some people go out and they're just like, all right, well, this is like bird watching, or they treat it like a hobby, or they treat it as if it's something that can be measured, and it can't. So it's very frustrating for my father and myself to view certain shows or hear from certain people, and it's, you know, it's just hard to deal with.
Well, it's funny, George, that the ghost hunters of that particular show are practically neighbors of ours here in Rhode Island. You know, it's a very small place. And your guest last night, one of your guests, Jeff Blanger, is lives in the next town from us.
Oh yeah,
in the Massachusetts Valley. So it's a small community. We all know each other, not well, but we don't agree, and we.
Well, we try to be diplomatic.
Precisely,
is really, really the thing, because we could be wrong.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. There's no really solid answers anywhere along, and as long as there's an honest sense of inquiry and people are trying to find answers, I salute them. Paul, on the sort of the same, the other side of the same coin is how science, mainstream science, looks at these topics. They don't think it deserves any investigation because they've already made up their mind about it.
Well, there are exceptions, George, of course, but not many. One of them, I think, is perhaps Stanton Friedman, the grandfather of ufology, who was kind enough to write the foreword for this book. But as a rule, I think we're still operating on, as Ben mentioned, the materialist paradigm. Everything is essentially coming down to matter, and even energy is, you know, interacting with other matter and all this business. But I think that, and again, I think it's an outdated point of view that's being blown out of the water by quantum mechanics. And what we know people in the sciences, and very often they don't talk to each other. For example, we both know a behavioral scientist, a very good friend of ours, very old friend of mine, who is, at conferences and things, they don't talk about quantum effects or what's being theorized or discovered by the physicists of consciousness. You know, behaviorism, it's still, you know, B.F. Skinner and maybe a little Freud in there. And it's just, you know, the sciences don't talk to each other because everything's pigeonholed.
Oh, yeah, and it's sort of a product of over-specialization.
Well, it is. And, you know, as Ben and I often say, in the traditional Western mind, you take things apart in order to understand them. In the traditional Eastern mind, you put them together in order to understand something. You consider the whole rather than its parts. Because as many sociologists have pointed out, the whole is more than the sum of its parts. And I think that can be applied to everything. So that's our point of view. We try to bring it together rather than divide it up and try to understand it in bits and pieces from a very narrow paradigm.
Let's sort of lay up a roadmap for where we're going to go for the next couple of hours. And that is this idea of the multiverse, the paranormal multiverse, if you will, and the framework that you guys establish in the book. You make a comparison of these various seemingly unrelated paranormal topics, and then sort of link them into modern physics idea of a multiverse. Paul, why don't you start with that, and then Ben, you can jump in.
Okay, well, again, this really came about not by studying it in a classroom. My degree is in philosophy, and as you mentioned, I graduated from two seminaries, so philosophy and theology. So obviously I'm not a physicist. However, you know, I'm not blind either, and I wasn't born yesterday. As I was going about various cases starting in 1970, 1971, and standing there with six other people and listening to an ox cart driver go by You could hear the wooden wheels, the hoofbeats of the oxen or horses. You could even hear a whip and the guy yelling like "Yah," but you couldn't see it 30 feet away. And when this sort of thing was happening, I was wondering, first of all, okay, we came here assuming, or at least my theory at the time was maybe these are souls in purgatory, the old Roman Catholic belief, I guess they still have it, that if you're not quite good enough to go to heaven, not quite bad enough to go to hell, there is a purgative state, hence the name, in which you are purged of any whatever, and then you can go to heaven. But these people, in this first case of mine, which was in Connecticut, showed no sign of being dead at all, never mind being in purgatory. So that was the beginning of wondering, even the theological theories, never mind the spiritualist theories, the spirits of the dead and all that, they just didn't seem to be good enough. So we didn't learn again in a classroom. We learned it by being in the trenches, seeing this stuff and finding no other explanation, but that we're dealing with a very physical, in most cases, realities that are side by side and that interact in a rather elegant way. This is often manifested, if you look at it, George, by, how many times have you or anybody you know, you put your keys down on the kitchen table, you're running and you're kind of in a rush, and you turn around and they're not there.
Or every single day, yeah. Every day,
This sort of thing, or somebody's following you in a car, and you're some cowboy, no offense to anybody in the West, and you look in the mirror and they're on your tail, and you get mad, and all of a sudden you look back and they're gone. There's really nowhere they could have turned. I think these are things we assume are one of those things that go on in our daily lives. But when something starts playing frisbee with your grandmother's fine china across your dining room, that's what we notice. But I think they're all symptoms of little glitches in the Swiss cheese nature of the multiverse, the interaction of these various worlds, many of which are very physical. And I began to see, I wonder why we would see ghosts, quote unquote, as wispy figures or as things of this kind, but because perhaps we're looking across what physicists refer to as the brains, as in membranes, B-R-A-N-E-S, of parallel realities, which are essentially electromagnetic. We get these in photographs, and we get these in various experiences where you see them on one side and going about their normal physical lives, doing something normal, and then looking at us and seeing the same things and getting frightened. We often have run into that. So there are many variations on this. You can bring it into UFOs and various cryptids, as they're called, cryptozoological phenomena,
which we've sort of run into in our study of flap areas.
Yes, flap areas. Now, since 05, we've gotten into flap areas.
Are you talking about UFO flaps or ghost flaps or what?
All flaps.
All flaps, yes.
Yes. Yeah. We would find that when we would investigate very often, and I found this early on, by the end of the 70s, you start investigating a house, say. People say they have footsteps in the attic or whatever's going on. But if you look outside the house, and this started by just the feeling, maybe I should look around the yard too, you'd often find, when you could talk to them, that neighbors were also having problems of similar kinds. You'd find a spike in UFO sightings in the area, if you checked with MUFON. You'd find even sometimes Bigfoot sightings in the area, and they were all taking place in a relatively limited area, extending sometimes out to several hundred square miles, and this is what we specialize in today. So this is where we've taken this, and in the book, we kind of lay out, as you say, the roadmap, George, and then in future books we'll
flap areas. I should say there's a graphic in the book, Ben, that it sort of looks like kind of like the Olympic rings, but it's each ring representing its own sort of reality that bleeds into and intersects with other realities. It's like our reality, I guess we think it's the central reality, and it is to us in some senses, but you show sort of a graphic blueprint of how it could work. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, it's a very simplistic and clip art driven way that we have come to explain the multiverse. One of the things people ask us, especially in our show, or if we're asked, as you just asked now, how does one describe the multiverse? And well, think of it like bubbles in a sink. So right after you wash your hands, you notice that there's some bubbles left over from the soap. Some bubbles pass into each other. Some bubbles expand. Some bubbles shrink. Some bubbles just pop. This is essentially what we're living in. All completely separate, sort of separate worlds that sort of interact with each other at all times. So we have in the middle of this sort of a Dracula-looking figure. We have another one that has a little UFO or an angel. Another one with I think that's Carl Jung.
Vincent Van Gogh.
Vincent Van Gogh.
It's Van Gogh.
You know,
yeah, I was gonna say
that's not contemporaries at all.
1910.
We have Loch Ness Monster in one, and they're all sort of interacting. You have one in like the corner where there's a guy that looks kind of concerned, looking at all these other bubbles that are interacting with each other and passing through one another. So we're seeing all of these worlds interacting at all the same times. So, for example, we just did a show not too long ago on places that just sort of disappear. As we've also written about that in our book, like different cases that we've found, different events that we've seen that people have told us about where there have been like towns that appear, hotels that appear, disappear. They're there one day, gone the next. Or we've had someone write into our show where he was driving by the same house for like, what was it, 10 years? It was red for every single day, and then one day it was green. And then he was like, oh, that's weird. Well, I wonder how long it's been green for. And someone was like, it's always been green. Like that, like little things like that, or something on the scale of ghost towns turning into Dutch settlements or whatever.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Utah, yeah.
That's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to interacting with the multiverse. So one would ask, how does this happen? How do these bubbles interact with each other? Well, from what we've seen and discussed with many experts, is it's all through electromagnetics. So if the ducks happen to line up in a row, then you have sort of paranormal phenomena happening. Like we've noticed whenever we have to deal with poltergeist cases, that usually there's like high water tables or they're near high tension wires or something to that effect that sort of exaggerates the world boundaries, so to speak. So often we get pictures of orbs, the ubiquitous orb that you see in pretty much every picture, like, oh, there's orbs all around this house. Well, we've sort of theorized that maybe these are plasma-based creatures that hang around the boundaries of different worlds. So essentially what we're trying to say here is that we're interacting with these worlds all the time. So in one world, I could push my dad over in the seat that's next to me, and that would create a completely separate and different world. Or I could push over this computer, or I could just hang up the phone right now, and each one of those would create an entirely separate world.
Never mind wrecking
exists.
The show.
Yeah, exactly. I could wreck the whole show, but we're not going to do that because we're in a world.
Well, somewhere you did. In some world, you probably did.
Yeah, exactly. somewhere I did. Same goes with imagination. How do we come up with ideas? Well, my dad always likes to point out The Great Pumpkin from Charlie Brown. So how would Charles Schulz come up with the idea for The Great Pumpkin if it didn't already exist somewhere, someone in the multiverse? Because somewhere, someone, The Great Pumpkin does exist.
Or some creature like that.
Yeah, exactly. So really what we're experiencing is sort of not only separate worlds interacting with each other, but sort of a great big collective unconscious, I suppose, to borrow from Carl Jung, where we all experience everything together.
It becomes a lot less spooky when you get your head around this. It occurred to me as I read your book.
I know we've got a break coming, but people often come up to us, and it's very satisfying when they say, you know, I've been frightened of this all my life, and now that I understand it, I don't have to be afraid of it anymore. That's a really satisfying thing to hear, because on the other hand, there are things you should be afraid
yeah,
of.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there are things you should be.
And we'll get into that, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, once you get your head around it, it's a comfortable kind of a feeling to it, but it does change your perception of everything, you know, everything.
It does. It really does. It transforms everything. And there is a deeper way to look at the multiverse, the bubbles, as Ben described.
I'll tell you what, we'll probably have to wait till the other side for this, because that sounds like that's going to get really good. We're talking with Paul Eno and Ben Eno about their book, Behind the Paranormal. It's also the title of their radio show, Blind Melon, No Rain, from 1992. This is a pretty awesome live cover version of it, of an early rock classic written by Carl Perkins. It's called Matchbox. That's Paul McCartney doing that version of it. And you can find that online. I'm not sure it ever appeared on an album, but it's a get the feet tapping and the pulse pumping. We're talking with Paul Eno and Ben Eno about their new book, Behind the Paranormal, sort of a master matrix for how all this stuff fits together. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the big picture stuff and then get into some specific cases that will chill you to the bone. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So before the break, Paul, we were talking about this reality once it comes over you, an appreciation for this version of the multiverse, this version of reality, how it affects people, and you wanted to make a point before we moved on.
Sure, George. One of the critical notions in this theory, if it's true, is that there are different versions of ourselves across the multiverse, and of course this gets into the human relationships within the multiverse and our vision of ourselves. And that would include the notion that every possibility, as we've said, is true at some point in concrete reality, at some point or somewhere or somewhere in the multiverse, one world or another. And the worlds, as Ben explained, interact in a rather elegant way. So, and it's all you. Okay, so in another version in another world, perhaps not far away, someone else is your guest this evening. In another part of the multiverse, George Knapp died in a UFO crash 30,000 years ago. I mean, you think of it, it's out there somewhere, apparently. This is the theory, all right? Now, taking that to its logical or illogical conclusion, it totally destroys what we refer to as the island theory. Okay, that the usual approach by most mainstream scientists is that our memories are somewhere inside our bodies, inside our brains, all encased in our physical structure. That's why there's disbelief, even to this day, in things like extrasensory perception, in things like precognition. All right. However, if you look at the multiverse idea, precognition and ESP and all these things are entirely normal. As Ben said, the paranormal becomes entirely normal with this particular point of view. So if you throw out the island theory and realize that we are all connected not only with other versions of ourselves, but ultimately with each other, okay, that that the old ideas just don't hold up anymore, that, you know, something, some part of you at death passes into some part of a residual state or an intelligent state of some kind, but that you can be you without your body, all that dualism just gets pretty much thrown away and, you know, as we say, blown out of the water. So that's really what this does to our self-perception. And I can give you an illustration, if I may.
Sure.
A very simple one. I love to speak at colleges and universities because not only do we get intelligent questions, but at the end they'll put me or us in a big armchair like a Santa Claus or something, and the kids will come up in pairs and they'll tell us their individual stories. Well, one day at Mount Ida College outside of Boston, this is a number of years ago, Ben wasn't even involved yet, I was speaking about these subjects and giving case studies and speaking about human relationships within the multiverse. And two freshman girls came up and said, perhaps you can explain something we don't understand. And that's that when we were registration day, hadn't ever seen each other before, we saw each other for the first time, we were sisters from the start. We felt a bond and a connection such as we never felt with anyone else. And I said, well, at some point in the multiverse, you are literally each other. And you both simply aware of that point, because we can't, at this point in our evolution, seemingly apprehend all the places where we are what we are, and all the times and places where this takes place, because it's all simultaneous, as Einstein indicated, because we're not quite up to that. And when we get to that point, they'll fill our pockets full of antipsychotic drugs and call us schizophrenic, okay? Not that there is no such thing as those diseases, but working in psychiatric hospitals, I got an eyeful and an earful about this stuff. So those two girls were absolutely delighted. They understood it immediately, and they went skipping, you know, merrily away, realizing why, at least if we're correct, why they felt like sisters from the start. And I think that this is a very simple indication of what is possible by as we call it, multiverse awareness.
Let's talk about sort of the broad stroke stuff that you explore early in the book. The idea that we humans lost something along the way, that at some point in previous centuries, I don't know whether time is linear or not, or what we consider earlier humans had a better understanding or recognition of other realities, other intelligences, and you can see it. I mean, you make a pretty convincing case, pulling evidence from different cultures and different continents and different centuries, that there was a recognition of some other kind of beings and intelligences throughout human history. Maybe, Ben, you can tackle that.
Oh, geez.
It's a tiny little,
well,
tiny
you know,
little
it's a big,
idea.
It's a you know, it's a big portion of human history, and I think the paranormal. Well, let's put it like this. So, philosophy and religion and science pretty much all stemmed from the same area, which was trying to describe the indescribable. I mean, how do you not only explain something that's going on in nature besides angry gods, but let's just say something coming and visiting you and bringing you fire or something like that, like the story of Prometheus, or even if we go farther back in the beginning of Genesis, depending on which translation you read, you have the Elohim, in other words, the Shining Ones, which is really interesting because it's a feminine noun with a masculine plural ending in Hebrew, which is very, very strange. So you can read the first portion of Genesis, and it could say, you know, as everyone else knows it, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. But you could also read it as, what was it, when it began, the Shining Ones stood in the heights and looked down with pleasure upon the highlands and the lowlands. So there's a very huge difference. So the question sort of arises is, well, I mean, how do we know what happened? So you can even see these parallel stories going on in not only in the Torah or Book of Genesis, but you can also see it going on in different books of the time as well, whether it's the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita, or what was the Sumerian stories?
Oh, yeah, the Karsag
epics. Karsag epics.
Yeah.
Sorry, a little late over here, so my mind is a little bit, is working a little bit slower than expected. So
you guys in the West Coast have it made.
Yes, indeed. So essentially, the paranormal in human history, we have sort of, well, I guess as the Taoists put it, I always enjoy the Tao's creation story because it was, they sort of look at it as man was connected with nature, or, well, the universe or the divine or the way. So man was connected with all things. But then something happened along the way where we sort of got distracted and made things more complex. So we pushed ourselves farther and farther away from nature and all things. So we sort of lose something in ourselves. Not only do we lose a portion of our human history or something that's inside of ourselves, but we gain a new understanding of, well, things that are not really important. So you have this sort of what lingers on in the Human Genome Project, as showed that there was, like, what was it, 200-something genes?
Yeah, 223 genes that shouldn't be there once they finished mapping the thing.
Right. So there's something that went on in human history that definitely changed us. Mm. What it was, we don't know. But, you know, it could be the influence of gods, as they put it, as we could put it. It's like if you go to the British Museum, you have one section where it's all the good gods, all the nice gods, Isis, Osiris, and stuff like that. Then you have another section where it's like all these weird little backyard gods. So who knows? Maybe it's how the humans interacted with maybe alien species, or maybe it's how we interacted with the world around us. But we'd like to think that something in the multiverse happened that changed us as a race and a species that definitely changed our perception of the world around us.
And then coming forward, of course, we have the modern age of education and the so-called Enlightenment that
that doesn't help either.
Took us really away from these ideas. But if you talk to one thing we did was to research we said, okay, who are the most ancient peoples on Earth? Who has the most lengthy, continuous, never mind gene pool, but also a core of tradition? And of course, we found several groups. The San and Khoisan Bushmen of Africa
and the Aboriginals.
The Aboriginals of Australia, certainly. You're looking at least 30,000 years of continuous tradition. And then the Andaman and Nicobar Islanders of the Indian Ocean. And when I was in Australia in 1979, I spent 7 hours, the better part of that, talking with a little guy named Mindalui, who was an Australian Aboriginal elder. And I was very lucky because they usually don't talk to to outsiders that readily. But we got into a conversation, and I told him I was doing paranormal research, things of this kind. And he said, "You're on the right track with this multiverse idea." He said, "You know, we will couch it in certain traditional terms, but essentially, what shamans do is to go into parallel realities, bring back to our world, or if." The physicists might say collapse the wave function to make it real here. healing cancer. For you go into a nearby world where you cross the membrane, go into a world where the person doesn't have cancer, bring it back, collapse the wave function, and make it real. He and another shaman in Quebec of the Cree tribe told me about actually bringing people back from the dead. You know, not resurrection, not reincarnation, but actually going into parallel worlds, grabbing people by the arm who had died in our consciousness, take them back across the membrane, and there they were. Not a good idea, as it turned out, but these are things that came up in the research.
Well, I think that people like to point fingers at religion as well and say that sort of closes off our mind to different ideas. But I'd like to point at something else that would probably be more problematic, which is culture, especially modern American culture, we don't really have one, so I'd say it's more of an anti-culture than anything else. It sort of tends to put us into this island, this sort of island mindset that my dad was talking about earlier, where we see everything from our own perspective, and we can't get outside of that perspective because it's constantly enforced, and we're going into that time of year where we're told, well, I mean, it's all about what you want and all that kind of stuff, and so it's we're in this mindset, especially in the West, where everything is all about me, 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 me. But once you expand yourself outside of that, you start to see and notice all these things that our ancestors had sort of gotten down, like down pat. They see how the world interacts around them. They put themselves back towards a more holistic way of living. And I think that it's a problem that we live in such a time where we have to deal with issues of ourselves and not be able to look outside of ourselves, to move past the mundane, to see what is not mundane, which is all of existence, which should be something that should be a part of our daily lives.
We had a guest last week, my guest, a guy named Tom Powell, who had written about Bigfoot. He'd written, he's written a couple of books about it. And his interest in Sasquatch has led him to places he never thought he would go, into a much bigger, more wondrous universe with UFOs and ghosts and things of that sort. I and many of my colleagues who started out as nuts and bolts UFO guys have made this same journey. Like a different spoke on a wheel, you know, coming at it from one perspective and then ending up someplace completely different. And the journey you're describing is very similar. You know, I guess where I wanted to head was the idea of hotspots where this stuff takes place versus the idea that you can find it wherever you want to look if you're willing to look. As Tom Powell said last week, you have to believe in Bigfoot before you can see the evidence for it, because otherwise, as you're talking, this cultural reinforcement, you don't look. You don't dare to go against the grain or question it. You don't look up at the sky and see stars. It's true, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll give you an example of that, George. In September, well, for years, and people would come up after lectures and some say, well, you know, I saw Bigfoot, and it was a sacred experience and all this business. And, you know, you take it with a pillar of salt sometimes, you know. But in September, it happened to me in a new flap area we're investigating. Ben hasn't been there yet, but I've been working with Shane Searway, a tremendous guy here in New England, who was a very good combination of a Blackfoot shaman and a very feet-on-the-ground investigator. Good combination. So I had literally what I believe. We don't make any claims, neither Ben nor I do, but I believe it was a Bigfoot sighting, and quite a dramatic one, totally unexpected. So yeah, I mean, I think that perhaps the entire human race is making the journey you just described from, you know, perhaps being connected with the earth and being aware of these things with the mother of both religion and science being the paranormal, because if there were no questions to be answered, if there were no mysteries, if there were no fears, there would be no religion or science, really, right? Going to a point of forgetting everything, perhaps, because, and we're talking about, you know, George, the times before so-called history, okay, 8,000 years ago or so when the Sumerians came along, there are millennia of empty time between that period and the beginnings of human race. We don't know anything about them. And what we do know is known, of course, from these civilizations we just described and the peoples who were considered so-called primitives, such as the Aborigines and the Andaman Islanders, et cetera, who do have a tradition reaching back to that. And their tradition says what we try to say in the book and what you and ourselves and many others have been discovering over the last 20, 30, 40 years, or rediscovering, perhaps I should say.
I want to get into the idea that it's not all flowers and rainbows, that there's some dark stuff out there. I think I'll wait until we get into the next segment. The Irish part of my family, there's a saying among the Irish part of my ancestors, they talk about places where the world is thin. And I think they're referring to places where, in the context of your book, where our world intersects with other world, other worlds, other realities. And we often, in this kind of research, will call them hotspots. Ben, give me your take first on whether you think hotspots are real for various phenomena, or whether or not every place is a hotspot if you look hard enough.
Well, I'll start that off with a little bit of an anecdote. When I was a senior in high school, I went on a trip with a couple other kids and one of the teachers, and we went to Navajo Reservation to do mission work. And out there, there's sort of a little portion of the Grand Canyon you can go and visit, and we went there our first day, and I was sort of getting into, at the time, my more spiritual training and, like, sort of a rule of meditation and stuff that I did. So I had a very big reverence for these places. And I remember a bunch of kids like, "Oh, we're going to go hiking or whatever." And I was like, "Well, I'm going to stay behind. I get this sort of feeling like, you know, this is a sacred place. I shouldn't mess with it." And so I stayed on top of this canyon and just sort of observed the beauty of nature, and come to find out, it was considered a thin place by the natives that lived in the area. And they went up to some of the kids that were trying to climb some boulders and stuff, and they were just like, "Hey, this is a sacred place. Don't mess with this place. It's a thin place." So I was like, "Oh, well, what do you know?" So these thin places do exist, and we have investigated a couple of them in our time, and excuse me, and we have a better understanding of them in such a way that they usually appear in sort of a triangular format, or at least the best that we understand. So places like the Bermuda Triangle, or even right near us with the Bridgewater Triangle, or even one of the ones that you mentioned in our book and in our cases and we've been talking about for years, which is the Litchfield-Connecticut Triangle. So these places do exist, and it's very fascinating how they interact with the world around them. And even in some of the great holy sites that we have around the world, let's say Stonehenge or places like that, they're sort of like the centers or the hubs of these areas, or even Rendlesham Forest, or different areas where paranormal activity seems to be heightened in a way, whether it's through the power of electromagnetics, because we found that these things tend to move. We haven't quite figured out why yet, or even formed a theory as to it yet, because this is sort of a new phenomena that we've been studying, but we've been keeping close tabs on them. So, for example, we could mention the documentary or the show promo.
Well, like, to a point.
Yeah, essentially. So a couple of years ago, this is what, 2010, where
was the first time somebody got to them, yeah.
Right. So we were shooting a pilot for a TV show that never came to fruition, and we discovered that this one house that was written about by our good friend Bill Hall, called The Haunted House Diaries, it was sort of one of these hubs of this triangle in this flap area, or a thin place, if you will.
I'll tell you what, that this is just getting good. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but we have to take a break. We're talking with Paul Eno and Ben Eno about their book, Behind the Paranormal. We will continue this story and hear several more when we come back. Cat Stevens with some good advice takes us into the break.